ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hey, I'm Sana Qadar, host of All in the Mind on ABC Radio National, and I have a question for you. Have you ever wondered what is going on inside someone else's head? I think about this a lot because on All in the Mind, we cover psychology and mental health and why people behave the way they do.
How do other people make this decision?
Maybe it's sending a signal to someone about the reliability of someone.
How can this possibly be?
So if you like the sound of that, check out All in the Mind on the ABC Listen app.
Welcome to Late Night Live, coming to you from Gadigal Land. I'm David Marr. In October 2023, Bob and Helena Carr were in Vienna. They knew the city well. They'd often visited. Bob wrote to his friends later that it had been a sweet day of walking and opera, in autumn weather, exploring sights we'd seen before. That night in their hotel room, Helena collapsed and died. Now, a couple of years down the track, Bob has written a book about their life together, the impact of her death, and what he calls the leftover life he's now living. Bob was, of course, Premier of New South Wales for 10 years and later Minister for Foreign Affairs. He's been out of Parliament now for 10 or 12 years, but he's still a big presence in public life. His book is called Bring Back Yesterday. Full disclosure, I have a blurb on the cover saying this is a memoir of raw and extraordinary power. I've just read it again, and I wouldn't change a word of that commendation. Bob joins me now. Welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you, David.
We'll come to that night in Vienna and its aftermath, but I want to begin at the beginning. In Tahiti, one morning in January 1971, when you have taken to the pool in the hotel to do your laps. Describe the scene and what follows.
Not much of a swimmer. It was more paddling. But in the party of Australian young Australian travellers on discount fares provided by the Australian Union of Students, all of us out of university for a couple of years, we were the only ones there. Helena sitting at the end of the pool reading a book and me doing a bit of paddling. And I paddled up to her and I asked her what the book was.
Your first words.
Yeah, always bookish and responding to the allure of the format. It was a book, the latest paperback of a Galbraith book. So she was an economist, letting me know that.
So who was she?
I later learned she came from what I can only describe as an idyllic small town, small city in Malaysia between Penang and Kuala Lumpur called Taiping. Taiping means peace, and it reflected the peace British colonialism brought after years of warfare between Chinese clans. It had grown rich on rubber and tin, and the tin mines were now the beautiful lake gardens that defined the town. It was a Chinese Indian culture, driven by the subgroups, subcategories under each of those nationalities, benefiting enormously from the British colonial administration. It's a world captured by, again, to be bookish, Anthony Burgess in Malayan Trilogy, the last years of British rule in the Malay Peninsula. And it was prosperous and stable, diverse, and the food was fabulous.
And who were you? Let me take a selection of descriptions of yourself by yourself from various places in the book. At this time, you see yourself as gauche, unworldly, ignorant, a prig, and an abrasive smartass.
All of the above.
Plus.
But still, I knew one thing, and that is that a career in the Labor Party, which is what I wanted, unabashedly.
And you're how old at this point?
I'm 22. Had to be built on a base in the branches. For all my ignorance, I grasped that great truth. For me, getting a seat in Parliament would happen because I had support in the Labor Party branches in the federal electorate of Kingston Smith.
I wonder what she saw in you at that point. I mean, your superb physique, of course. She had, you write in the book, watched you joking and being a smart ass at breakfast at a table adjoining hers, and she rather thought that she'd like to be on that table.
Yeah, she said to me later, oh, we wish we were at that table. They seem to be having all the fun. So she got to know me as someone who worked for ABC Current Affairs Radio and was learning some basic things in that were to stand me in good stead. And she got to see me in the chair at meetings of New South Wales Young Labor and debating luminaries of the left in a campus setting. And I think she liked the idea. She admitted she liked the idea of being married to someone in politics, I think in the quest for an interesting life. And she probably preferred me, and here I'm referring to a world you're familiar with, to the beer-drinking, football-following enthusiasts of the campus colleges, the boys' colleges, St. Paul's, St. John's, the Catholic one, and offered something different.
And she indeed had been rather in love with a man from the Anglican St. Paul's College, where it just happens I went a long time ago. And they disapproved of the notion of their son marrying such a woman.
She never told me that. I knew there'd been a previous relationship, but it was only talking to girlfriends of hers after a death that they painted a picture of her sobbing for 3 days on a lounge in their house. One girlfriend said she was a big, soggy mess. And they told me something Elena had never admitted to. That is, the boy's parents had ruled out him marrying this Asian girl.
How wonderful for you.
Yeah, it was one of the strokes of luck I've had in my life.
I wonder whether both of you saw in each other that you were on long journeys. She from a little city in Malaysia, you from a fibro in Maroubra, and you both had big ambitions to go a long way.
I think she did. She saw that I wasn't going to waste my time as... She said to me once, I knew that you knew what you wanted, drawing a contrast with the...
beer swilling.
The beer soakers, football enthusiasts on the campus. And I think there's some truth in what you say. And I found her interesting because unlike girls I'd known on the University of New South Wales campus, here she was with a degree in economics... A businessman told me, and she never boasted this, she never said this to me, she was the only woman in the economics honours year that he was in.
Late 60s, early 70s.
Yeah, and I thought, if you think about it, that's something that might have been a boast, might have been a bit of one's personal mythology, but it was always beneath her dignity to boast. I'm not arguing perfection of character here. I say this in the book, but on that front, in the circles of journalists and politics, this is rather refreshing.
Talking about perfection of character, Bob, where did you go on your first date?
Yeah, we went. We had dinner at a place at King's Cross called the Little Dutch Inn, and then we went across the road to what was then the Nimrod to see a performance of starring Kate Fitzpatrick in Hamlet on Ice. I was part of the renaissance of Australian theatre at this time with these irreverent comedies. And Kate Fitzpatrick stalked the stage in a bodice and lace stockings, like a pantomime role, but playing Hamlet.
And where did you go on your second date?
It was to a Labor Party fundraiser at Lane Cove. And I said this in the eulogy and got a good-natured laugh. But... she never found them tedious. She enjoyed the fun of politics, and within a couple of years, we for example were introducing our friend Paul Keating to Malcolm Turnbull, who I'd got to know on another front.
You introduced those two men?
Yeah, I did, and it's very interesting looking back. There was a sort of mutual regard and curiosity about the other. And I remember Malcolm saying very wittily, he said, They said Lang was greater than Lennon. What are they going to say about Keating? He's greater than Kerensky? I said, quite possibly.
But they haven't. That's the first time I've ever heard such a suggestion. It hasn't entered the language.
No, it hasn't. And Paul, for his part, was very curious about Malcolm. There's no suggestion, by the way, that Malcolm would be recruited to our side of politics. I remember finding it completely unsurprising when he surfaced in the Liberal Party pre-selection for Wentworth and came unexpectedly close to getting it.
Yes.
A big achievement for someone so young.
Yes. In the book, you show Helena as doing not what I would call the chores, but the work of a politician's wife, of going to the meetings, of going to the celebrations, of being there with you, of being a political couple. What do you think makes a great politician's wife, or indeed husband?
I think enjoying people, interacting with people, I think that's the key. And there might have been something in her background in Taiping where her family was very respected. They weren't grand. Her mother was a senior nurse. Her father had been a nurse and was now a hospital administrator. He Indian, the mother Chinese. But there are always people in the house, other public servants, the Indian Chinese professionals and administrators. The church was quite a bit of it. The church was across the road. She went to a convent school where she excelled. But all of it speaks of a fondness for meeting people and a capacity to sit and listen. I don't think this is necessary, but it was part of her personality,
and to
sit
advise,
and listen very often.
And to advise you?
Very, very, very selectively. So she'd watch the ebb and flow of politics and I'd come down. She'd been listening on the radio to an interview I might have done in the morning, and we'd just exchange mocking mechanical laughter that registered her approval at how I'd rounded off an interview with Alan Jones or Radio National. With her occasional going to mass periodically, and insights into what I would describe as the relaxed world of Sydney Catholicism, she thought the church was being silly in opposing embryonic stem cell research. But back in the 90s, she sort of warned me about euthanasia. It was still a big jump for her to contemplate the concept of assisted dying. But there wasn't a flow of advice from her.
Meanwhile, she sets out on a business career.
Yeah, and as I explored it, again, big achievements. She was in the world of security printing, that is printing passports, bank documents, stamps, picking up contracts from around the world, and beginning to explore the world of cards and ATMs before they'd taken off. She was really in the front rank. There wasn't much she didn't know about the printing press out of Chullora, the Fairfax, I think it was, printing press. She knew all that stuff, all that world, and pulled together contracts, merged companies, got deals from unions. And as I say in the book, David, she never boasted about it. The scale of what she did was considerable, never boasted.
People were always surprised to hear this because she was this wonderful company, cheerful woman, your wife, etc. But there was this whole other life. And yet she had time to do one or two things for you. Now, I don't want to embarrass you with this list, Bob, but we do have to go through it in the interests of clarity. Have you ever driven a car in your life?
Yeah, I got a license.
You did get a license?
Yeah, I got a license, but didn't enjoy it. A bit phobic about it.
So Helena drove you to work, and she picked you up from work in her black Mercedes.
Yeah, and it was a special part of the day, those journeys, because you'd exchange comments on the news flowing out of the radio and
yes,
talk about things.
She packed your bags.
Not quite, no.
She did your banking.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, she was an economist, of course.
Well, of course. She had special skills. All technological issues around the house were solved by her, I take it.
She's good at fixing things, yeah. Mm.
The arrival of FM radio is treated in the book as a moment of kind of cultural triumph.
Yeah, the noise that came out of an FM radio struck us with wonder. But she had set it up, yeah, if that's the point you're making. Mm.
But together you also discovered Europe and discovered European culture. And that was a shared passion for you both.
Totally. She never complained of the itineraries I settled on. No.
Oh, did you do the itineraries?
Yeah, for the most part, yeah.
But she made them happen.
Yeah, yeah. She struck up the relationship with a little travel agency in Slovakia, and she was on first name terms with the guy who ran it as a family business, and she'd squeeze a deal out of him.
Terrific, terrific. I've had a couple of people say to me they liked you more because of her.
And I think the party got onto that round about 2003 when the general secretary said in this campaign, we'll just, you're going to be re-elected, Bob, but we'll just freshen things up by having Helena play a role. And I said, you won't get her. She will not do public speaking, let alone appear in a television ad. But I remember getting a glimpse through the glass door that separated my office from the conference room, and I saw the General Secretary, Eric Rizendahl, talking to her. And I saw her in profile, that lovely nose of hers. She was just nodding intently as she absorbed the message, if you do this, you will help Bob hold the seats that gives him his big majority.
And she did.
She did.
She was persuaded.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live, and I'm talking to Bob Carr about his wife, Helena Carr, and the life that he's lived since her death. Was there any suggestion that she was ill, that she was that she faced any kind of medical challenge?
I was always scared of breast cancer because I didn't believe her when she assured me that she was being tested. There was something, I think, inherited from a Chinese ancestry that resented any confrontation with mortality. I had to have a major argument to get her to sign a will. I found out after her death that she did not, in fact, get tested for breast cancer. That was the thing I was worried about, given it's so commonplace. But she did have a blood pressure challenge, and very quietly, without drawing my attention to it, with a machine, she tracked her blood pressure, and that may have been the explanation for the aneurysm that saw her lose consciousness that night in Vienna.
Tell us about that night, because you write about it very candidly, very beautifully in the book.
She came out of the bathroom. We were back in the hotel room after we'd seen the opera. She'd been joking with me in the short walk to our hotel from the Staatsoper. And she went in to do some washing in the bathroom, wash her slacks. And she came out, her hair falling over her eyes as she sat on the edge of the bed. And she said, I forget the adjective, a strange or a eerie pain in my back. I later heard from a brain surgeon that was blood from the aneurysm flowing into a spinal column. And then we descended into what might have been 20 or 30 minutes. I remember Googling symptoms, stomach upset, headache, back pain, 77-year-old woman. She was attempting to retch, then coming back. And there came a point when she couldn't answer questions like, do we get a taxi? We'll go to a hotel emergency. Well, I call an ambulance. And then retching into the basin, she fell back in my arms. And that was the loss of consciousness as I broke her fall and lowered her to the tiles. That's how it comes. That's for any couples listening to this, the lesson, I think, is it can arrive so suddenly after an idyllic day, just a perfect day of walking around, being in one another's company.
That afternoon, you'd gone to an exhibition of paintings of Egon Schiele, and you had seen a quote of his that rather struck you, and you scribbled it on your admission ticket, and it was in your pocket.
Yes, the Haunting Paintings by Schiele, who's just such a terrific artist, and on the plaque accompanying one in the Leopold Museum, devoted to the art of the secession, there's a quote from him. I think it was, death is in all living things.
Mm.
And I was struck by it. I wrote it on the ticket, an entry ticket to the museum. And perhaps your mind works like this. It's a memento mori, and you think by noting this, by honouring the presence of death, you're warding it off.
Yes, you'll protect yourself by being so alert.
Yeah.
Yeah. That night, what was the predominant emotion that we're all going to feel at that moment?
If death arrives like that, and I've discussed this with Geraldine Brooks, who wrote about it, getting a telephone call that Tony had been found dead and you spoke to her on this program.
Yes, the Australian writer.
Yeah. I think it's the shock. The shock is a carapace. It's a suit of armour that enables you to do things when...
It sort of protects you.
So after the ambulance had departed from the front of the hotel and vanished into the darkness of the Ringstrasse at midnight, I returned to the room, and it's only a state of shock that would permit one at that point to do practical things, make phone calls, begin to change travel arrangements, make contact with people who can advise you. And in the space between doing that, I looked through the luggage, which was her domain. She kept me out of it. In the carry-on bag she had, I find this very touching, there was a little corner devoted to the medicines that she'd filled the scripts for me so I'd be protected during the travel. And they were there so neatly packed, I couldn't have missed them, as if she'd been saying at the time, if anything happens to me, my friend will have no trouble finding this. I'll be in this corner of my wheeled carry-on bag. And I thought that was her love for me manifest, even as she was being taken to the Donau Clinic in the ambulance, unconscious and never to regain consciousness.
Arrangements are an act of love, aren't they?
Yeah. Yeah, she was thinking of me, and in the big suitcase I found the gloves and the beanie that I would need. How she found them in our untidy bedroom cupboards, I don't know.
Mm. A secret never to be revealed, yes. You talk about the wild dog of bereavement. So this is after, shock wears off, and then this wild dog of bereavement. And you write very beautifully about this in the book. And I'm very interested in what you will admit to and what you wish to ward off. You'll admit to having been crackers. You'll admit to self-pity. But definitely that you were not depressed. What's the distinction that you're reaching for there?
I made myself an expert in the literature of this. I could give an adult education course in.
I'm going to allow you to give very briefly that course. But it
was not what Joyce Carol Oates described in her book, A Widow's Journey, which was heavy medication, entire sleep loss, heavy medication, and a veering in the direction of suicidal contemplations. It was not that, and that's what I would describe as depression. This is not mental illness. It's an aching sense of the absence, manifest in all sorts of ways, but I wouldn't want to relive the 3 months or the 6 months after a death. Mm. for anything, and I admit to being cracked and talking about it obsessively. And on those mad long walks I describe in the book, composing conversations with her, writing letters to her, reliving what I'd said in the eulogy, which I knew I had to make the speech of my life in St. Mary's. And then there comes a time to this, in this sense, it is a journey rather than a place. There comes a time when you think there are no more tears. My memories now are of her merry spirit flitting around me. And this is something I can dwell on, choose to dwell on without a descent into tears or aching sadness.
And never a thought of suicide.
No. The life force is too strong for me. I just wonder whether someone else can comment on this, an expert in suicide, but I just wonder whether it is at all a response, whether it figures at all as a response, as an explanation of suicides. I think there are other notions too, like the assistance you get from friends being so brutally repudiated were one to take one's own life. And also the sense, and I think it's C.S. Lewis in A Grief Observed who uses the argument, others as well, Julian Barnes might, in his dissertation on the same subject, the loss of a partner, that by choosing to live, you're keeping alive the personality, the spirit of the lost partner.
You had an exchange with that great actress, Harriet Walter. She's been on Late Night Live.
So indirectly, she was quoted to me, Harriet Walter.
Oh, she's a great
actress through Lizzie Spender, Barry Humphrey's widow.
That's she right. It came to you down a chain of wise women.
Yes.
And Harriet's message to Barry Humphrey's widow was, keep going. You will come to a bend in the river. Have you come to a bend in the river?
Well, the no more tears and the memories don't floor me. Dwelling on the memories is possible. I like the concept of the leftover life because of its realism. I'd say to someone in my position, you're living something we can talk about as the leftover life. The real life was indeed, you're right, the one where you, which you shared with a partner for 50 years, so that in Tolstoy's words, you don't know where the one ended and the other began. That was, you honour that, you can choose to go back and inhabit that space when you want to. You can say, I'm going for a walk and I'm just going to dwell nostalgically, unapologetically, descending into nostalgia. But hang on, you've still got a life here. That's the leftover life, but it's still got wonderful things in it. It's still got wonderful things in it. You think of what it all will say. As long as I live, I'll be fascinated by the English language, by the surface of the earth, and by scraps of useless information. So that's available to you.
Still.
You've lost the partner. Lost the partner. The life, the quality of the life is just measurably reduced. But you can plunge headfirst into a wave at Coogee. You can be astonished by words on the printed page. You can see a movie that grabs you.
For a while, though, I thought this was really interesting. You couldn't read a book.
No. Because they were all deficient. There was one big thing in my life, and they weren't addressing it. The books I wanted to read were Julian Barnes on the loss of his wife and C.S. Lewis, the only book by C.S. Lewis I've read. I'm not drawn to his works on Christian theology. But like W.H. Auden in a poem called Funeral Blues, pack up the moon and dismantle the sun. How can you talk about these things when the big thing is this loss?
But you did come to read about loss and grief and bereavement. And What did you learn from that that you would not have been able to work out for yourself?
Well, Geraldine Brooks says Tony's death is the biggest thing about her. That's true. C.S. Lewis said living grief is comparable to being slightly drunk or concussion. I'd take that and I'd say physically it's like a metallic taste in your soul. You feel a metallic taste there.
You say again and again in the book about the bitter taste of grief. Really a taste, something you can identify in your mouth.
No, not literally, but in your soul.
Right.
In your
right.
soul. And there's a peculiar thing that for weeks after, I was able to feel, when I woke up at night, I'd feel the depression in the bed. So that's your mind registering. There's some loss, huge loss here, because for 50 years you were two parts of a single being, or became that after.
Yes.
Say after 30, perhaps.
Yes. But you talk about the silence of the house, and that's something that I immediately understand. But you also say something completely wonderful, which is you miss the jokes.
Yeah, and it's not original. It's from Joan Didion. She says in her book, The Year of Magical Thinking, about the death of her partner, John Gregory Dunn, who, like her, a screenwriter, novelist. She says, no one else will know the jokes.
And the jokes can be quite cruel, but they are part of marriage, deeply so. On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Bob Carr. Bob, you say something completely wonderful about Helena. She taught you happiness. How? And were you an unhappy young man?
I think I had the sort of simmering disaffection. I could have been drawn into the literature of the time. You know, Colin Wilson, The Outsider, and all the rest. Her view was, you don't dwell on anything negative, and you don't mix with negative people because they'll make you miserable. She was one of those people who just grew up. Yeah, that idyllic world of Taiping I described, the youngest of six youngsters. I think the happiness she had, that it was her spirit, was reflected. That background. I always thought that, and I remember thinking that if I'm ever speaking, if she dies before me, that's something I would say about her, and indeed I said it. I never shared that with her. But she was just an instinctively happy spirit, and that rubs off.
But were you, I mean, you write about being a 15-year-old child when you decide you are going to go into politics. How coherent was that ambition? And did it, in fact, you know, did the pursuit of it make you happy? Was it satisfying? Or was it just compelling ambition?
Oh, it meets all the tests of being satisfying. One, you commit yourself to something bigger than yourself. You commit yourself to an institution, the Labour Party. If I'd been a different person, it might have been something different. It might have been a church or a respected news organisation, Sydney Morning Herald, the New York Times, ABC, working with others, you know, young Paul Keating, Laurie Brett, and Graham Richardson and the others in this this little subculture of the youth wing of the Labour Party in New South Wales. All of us from working class backgrounds with outsized ambitions for public service, for public activity. So, you tick the boxes, you learn happiness.
Yes, but was that an ambition to make things better? Or were you sort of enjoying the thrilling prospect of being in the machine.
Being in political leadership, making things better. That was it. So I was inspired by the nation-building achievements of the Curt and Chifley governments, and by the dream that we could do that again, and that under Whitlam's leadership, Labor would become the majority party of Australian politics. Gough would be, if you like, our Menzies. I was a teenage Whitlamite, and something to believe in quite passionately. But it was the validity of political ambition, because it was a noble, utterly noble thing. We want to make this country better. We want to make it more independent, more interesting, more, above all, more equal. It might have been a sort of, it was a social democratic, one might even say a Scandinavian vision
of, right.
of Australia back in the 70s, and hence everything was invested in our faith in a modernised Whitlam-led Labor Party.
And so you moved into the suburbs in Sydney, which you hoped one day to represent in Parliament.
Yeah.
I mean, joined the local branch, naturally. And who did you take along to the local branch?
Well, I took along Helena.
Yeah, because?
And because when we married, I carefully insisted on a flat within the branch boundaries. Because I knew, the great truth I knew is that you only get somewhere, you only build a political
career. On the branches.
On the branches. And I would be secretary of Maroubra branch, and I would build that as a base.
And
I knew also, David, the truth that the hardest thing, as Benjamin Disraeli and Paul Keating discovered, the hardest thing is getting the bloody seat. Once the titanic struggle to get a safe Labor seat is the big challenge. After that, getting in the ministry, rising through ministerial ranks, in my case, taking over the leadership after an electoral disaster that took the more credible senior people out of the party, they lost their seats, and even becoming premier, that is all easier than the struggle to find a seat.
And in that struggle to find a seat, you signed your wife, Helena, up because, as you write in the book, you needed her vote.
Yeah, I needed a vote, and she found the antics at branch meetings very funny.
She enjoyed along. It.
Yeah.
And can you be certain, Bob, that she always gave you her vote?
Yeah, well, it never came to a pre-selection. I did my job so well that when the seat became vacant, I got the pre-selection unopposed. Indeed, when the ministerial vacancy occurred on the death of the late Paul Lander, I got the ministerial post unopposed, and then I got the leadership unopposed.
They were such desperate times for the Labor Party that they would let even you have a seat, have a shadow ministry, and even the leadership.
That's right.
Yes. What now are your political enthusiasms? Because you've always been a writer. This is your sixth book. You've always been a writer, always been a politician. What are your political enthusiasms still?
Well, a pamphlet-like book on the case for not going to war with China, contemplating a sunny Sunday afternoon when an American president rings our Prime Minister waiting in his office in Parliament House with the National Security Committee of Cabinet down the corridor, convened, and says, this thing's happened in the South China Sea or the Taiwan Strait. We expect you to be with us.
Join us.
The Japanese cabinet has just committed. And I'd like to make, I'd give the book the title, Sorry, Mr. President.
I think you've got about five publishers reaching for their phones right now. Bob, this book is also honouring debts to people along the way who've meant a great deal to you. And while I deeply admired your account of your English teacher at school, I was brought up short by the discovery that you are one of those politicians who at high school studied Macbeth. Now, I've always thought this was a bad sign in a politician.
Well, it's the shortest of his tragedies.
We're not talking efficiency here, man.
It's Lincoln's favourite play. The images of darkness and blood, which figure so big in Shakespeare's language in Macbeth, were perfectly attuned to Lincoln's terrible, oppressive thoughts as the battle news casualties were telegraphed to the War Office next to the White House. But the language is just terrific. Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow creeps in this petty pace from day to day.
Until
the last syllable of recorded time and all our yesterdays, etc.
Etc., of course. But it is, as it happens, a play about knifing your way to the top. And I'm not sure that as a model for a would-be Labour leader, Macbeth is a good place to start.
But I think that path is terribly flawed. If I'd been coaching Macbeth as his media consultant, pollster, I would have said, now listen, that is an option. And I know that you're under a lot of pressure at home to kill Duncan. But can I suggest something else? Duncan's an old man. You're on the path to the top. Wait till he dies and then kick his sons in the guts and seize it then. In the meantime, have a lot of wonderful dinners here in the castle and make yourself everyone's choice.
Yeah. It rings true. It rings true.
Meanwhile, we've got polling data
that shows
the aristocratic elite of Scotland rather likes your style. But if you could loosen up a little, smile more often, they'd like you more. Faced with the choice between you and those ungainly sons of Duncan, you might in fact be their preference. It'd be an easier path than this descent into
blood. This sounds like Harriet Walter again, who on this show was talking about her alternative plots for Hamlet. That in fact, Hamlet's mother never liked her, never liked his father, was thrilled to be rid of him, and married her true love. Anyway, look. Enough of Shakespeare.
By the way, yes. the happiest marriage in all of Shakespeare, according to Harold Bloom, is the Macbeths.
Oh, dear. Look, we won't... I don't want to give for a moment the impression that your marriage to Helena was anything like the marriage of the Macbeths, so I think we should stop this conversation right here. Bob, can you still talk as you spoke before you had voice coaching?
Yeah, I probably descend into it when I'm lazy, tired. But the what I had to get rid of was the oi oi sound in the broad Australian accent and the monotone that is characteristic and can even be detected in the wonderful voice of Robert Menzies, for example. All of us Australians have got, compared to educated Southern English, something of a monotone. You can't really energize that out of existence.
I ask you this question, of course, because one of the people that you pay homage to in this book was your voice coach. And I'm very interested, you mentioned it yourself, that your model was Menzies. It wasn't Chifley and it wasn't Whitlam, but it was Menzies. Why Menzies?
I could never reach the Menzies level, but I love the way the vowels just flutter, the enunciations... Perfect. If you listen to enough of him, you can find the occasions when tired or nervous, he loses some of it. But I've often fantasized that if someone spoke like Menzies today, the new leader of the Liberal Party, Angus Taylor, for example, they'd be halfway there. It'd be such a...
Really? Haven't political voices changed, though, in the most interesting way? There's no one speaks like Chifley anymore. No one remotely speaks like Chifley. And if another Menzies, if somebody's speaking as Menzies did, wouldn't they seem from another time?
Yeah, it's interesting. The voices of recent prime ministers, Turnbull, Abbott, Rudd, have been quite neutral. There's nothing about the style of those three that would have been an interference with the message. Gillard had problems with a flat, somewhat nasal, I think, Australian intonation. And Anthony's worked at his speech.
Albanese.
Yeah.
Yeah.
but would be the first to admit that he's a long way from the enunciation of a Menzies or a Whitlam. But it's interesting to think that Abbott, Turnbull, Rudd had neutralized their accents, and their voices were such that if anyone were nominating reasons for not liking them, there would have been no grating quality in the voices that would have been the cause of that dislike.
Now, alas, your vocal coach is no longer in the business, because she could teach the Prime Minister something she taught you: how to deliver a joke. The hazards of delivering a joke. A wonderful anecdote in the book.
Yeah, she had me speak to her association of voice teachers. And I was a backbencher, I think, maybe a minister at the time. And I said to her, Gina, I started with a joke. I thought it was as jokes go, that was okay. She said, I got no response. And she said, well, there's a simple reason. You let your eyes drop. They need to see in your eyes a permission to laugh. They need to get that almost telepathic conveyance that we're in this together and we're laughing together. She was so good. She was just so good. First time I went to her, 1979, tapped on a door, and then saw that she was a woman living with polio. She came from a working class background. She studied at the Guildhall in London, and she was a voice coach for big name actors. I think Mel Gibson, if he needed to get a Scottish or Welsh accent, she'd be the voice coach, the accent coach. And it was just a gift to get her. And then I speculate in the book that when I really needed her craft, that was the funeral that had to be the speech of my life, the eulogy for Helena. And it's almost as if there's a Proustian tendril of time. 1979, journalist at the Bulletin, itching to get a seat in Parliament, I knock on her door to sign up for my first voice lesson. And then 2026, she's been dead for years, but I'm drawing on everything she taught me to give a eulogy for my wife. Was it preordained when I got the bus from Park Street to Randwick to see her that there'd be that link? These are the little puzzles of time. Who can? You know, when I met Helena at that swimming pool, how is it possible to imagine the 50 years of shared life that would come out of that? I just think the wonder of time challenges us, undermines us throughout.
Can you imagine another life where you didn't do your laps that morning in the pool?
Only with difficulty. Maybe I would have gone on. I'm sure I would have gone on, and politics would have been my career. But to me, it's inconceivable that without that merry presence, without the lambent eyes and that ready smile, that I could have done all that leadership of the party for 17 years, 10 and a half years as Premier.
Mm.
Her spirit flavours it and was a source of such strength. But here we're talking about a near universal experience, David. This is the loss of a partner. And I really hope the book provides something, as other people's books have provided something for me, in answering that question. My partner died a day ago. What is this world I now inhabit of bereavement? Bereavement is on me. I hadn't planned this, but it's on me. It's arrived without warning. How do you arrange your existence for the leftover life?
Bob, thanks for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thanks, David.
I have been speaking to Bob Carr, former Premier of New South Wales, former Foreign Minister of Australia, author, former journalist, and the widower of a great woman, Helena Carr. Thank you.
Thank you, David. Thank you. That's a lovely tribute to her. Thank you. Thank you.
Bob's book is published by Allen & Unwin. Bring Back Yesterday, on losing the love of my life and doing what it takes to survive. That's the week, and so that means it's Chatterbox time. We heard from several of you about my discussion with Ronan McRae, gay and Irish, who's just published a book, The End of the Gay Rights Revolution, How Hubris and Overreach Threatens Gay Freedom. Some of you were appalled that we'd given McRae the time of day, but Late Night Live is in the business of listening to uncomfortable voices, challenging them, of course, but letting them speak. But Myrna, writing from Perth, found McRae's cautionary tone sobering and worth considering. She wrote, "As a black woman who lived in the USA for a number of years and has close family still living there, I'm acutely aware of recent challenges to conditions hard won by non-white people in the USA. The struggle for civil rights, for genuine equality, had achieved some real wins, but we can observe the current US administration undoing some of the gains at a dizzying pace. Women's rights, access to equal treatment in employment, etc., are also under threat. I'm shocked at how quickly regressive change can occur. I don't want to be alarmist, and like McRae, I'm not suggesting that gay people should return to the closet. I do, however, accept and respect his admonition that the bear should not be poked." Yes, yes. Chatterbox is the time we own up to our gaffes. Now, discussing the Royal Commission into Anti-Semitism and Social Cohesion the other day, my old friend and former Late Night Live presenter Richard Ackland remarked that this was a unique official investigation into amorphous things like feelings, perceptions. I should, at that point, have leapt in to correct him. An email from Gail does the job for me. "You forgot the Royal Commission into Human Relationships, established by Gough Whitlam in 1974. It sounded sort of soft at the time, but it was groundbreaking, almost literally lifted the lid on love and marriage, etc., like never before." Fair enough. We were talking the other day about the very first performance at the Sydney Opera House in 1960 by Paul Robeson, a year into the construction. The building was not much more than a hole in the ground. 100 or so workers at lunchtime were hanging from the scaffolding. Robeson, in a heavy three-piece suit on a hot November day, was brushing away the flies. Robeson sang Old Man River, but Rob Vines reminds us he also sang that union anthem, Joe Hill.
"One of our great heroes in the American working class movement. They framed him on a murder charge, but his spirit still lives in the hearts of all the American working class. I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake City, Joe, says I, him standing by my bed. They framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I ain't dead. Says Joe, but I ain't dead."
My thanks, as always, to the team. Ali Benton, Anne Arnold, Alex Tai, and our leader pro tem, Madame Catherine Zengerer. Until next week.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.